afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Small Town on the River, a podcast that takes a close look at the life and music of Bill Morrissey. For our first episode, I am thrilled to have musician, writer, and music historian Elijah Wald. Elijah and I talked for a good hour about the early days with Bill. I hope you enjoy it. The beginning of the interview got cut off, so I'm going to plug it in where I got it here. Thanks for listening.
He played there very regularly. He was one of their... he was one of their featured performers. I saw him a whole bunch of times at the Idler. And that was... That simply was what made him in Boston.
I see.
I was playing at the Idler opening for Spider John Kerner. And who came, I forget whether during the break or afterward, and introduced himself and said, Dave Van Ronson said that he should come hear me.
That's what Bill said? Bill was told? Yeah. But, okay, cool. So to Dave Van Ronk effectively connected that dot.
Yeah, Dave Van Ronson told Bill that he should come check me out.
What was your relationship with Dave Van Ronk at the time?
I had been a student of his. I was a very close friend of his. I ended up meeting the person who wrote his autobiography.
Right.
Which is a strange sentence, but it's true.
Right. So what could you keep going? That's fascinating. That really helps connect that dot. So what happened once Bill came to see you play?
We had a few drinks, and then we started getting together now and then. He was living with Jeff McLaughlin on Appleton, Appleton Place. It was off Appleton Street, but it was a tiny little dead end.
Okay.
And Bill was living there right at the end. He was living in an upstairs room in a place it was an apartment of Jeff McLaughlin, who wrote Boston Globe.
Okay. Interesting.
That's how I became a writer. Was my Jeff getting me in on the Globe after I met Jeff. And after I was just hanging out there with Bill all the time.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Jeff had interviewed Bill for the Globe and then invited him to come stay with him.
Okay. Wow.
Jeff ran sort of... He was single and he had a fairly big place. And basically became a place where musicians passing through town regularly stayed. But Bill moved in full-time. I don't remember for how long. I would offhand say a year, maybe 2 years.
Wow. Very interesting.
If you could figure out when he married Lisa, when he got together with Lisa, that was when he was living with Jeff.
Understood.
So it's his first wife.
Right. Understood.
And the whole plan of calling Lisa and her coming to visit, that all happened to Jeff.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
And it was completely insane, but it for a moment there, it was the perfect romantic story, and then after a while it wasn't.
I understand. That helps me kind of ground the scene. So that's it. Sorry, I'm not familiar with the Boston area. That's in downtown Boston, or that's in the surrounding area?
No, Cambridge.
Oh, Cambridge. I see.
All of this is in Cambridge.
I see.
As far as Bill's career was concerned, Boston might not have existed.
I see. Interesting.
I am not aware of Bill ever playing in Boston.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's not quite true. I'm sure in later years he did in Boston.
Okay.
But in the period I'm talking about, I mean, there really pretty much wasn't any place to play in Boston.
I see.
I mean, he lived in Cambridge when he moved down from New Hampshire to stay with Jeff. he was living in Cambridge on Appleton, as I say, I think it was Appleton Place. Would be easy to look up, as I say, there's Appleton Street, and then there's this little dead end that's also called Appleton.
And it was the street, or it was the dead end?
Well, Appleton Street is between Huron and Brattle.
Okay.
And then there's this little dead end off Appleton Street that I think was called Appleton Place.
That makes sense.
It's still there. You can find, you know, look on Google. You'll have no trouble finding it.
Sure. So, yeah.
The Idler was in Harvard Square in Cambridge. It was a bar. And he then moved on from the Idler and started playing at Potting Coffee House, which if you look it up later became Club Potting, but at that point it wasn't. At that point it was Potting Coffee House. P-A-S-S-I-M.
I've seen that name a lot.
Which he didn't like, and they didn't like him, but it was the classy room to play in town.
Why didn't they like him, or why didn't he like them?
Because the owner, a guy named Bob Doblin, Bob was an interesting guy. Bob had actually been on the road with Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy. But Bob had had a drinking problem and had quit.
Okay.
And so was a pretty crabby, I mean, I like him, we always got along great, but he could be crabby, and he was a reformed alcoholic, and Bill brought beer into the dressing room.
Right.
And, I mean, Bill didn't yet have a drinking problem, but he did have a beer before he went on stage.
Right.
And Domblin did not approve of anyone who drank being in his club, and Bill did not approve of Domblin being a pain in the ass about it.
I see.
And also, Bill liked bars. I mean, the Idler was a bar. The Idler was a real dance bar. I mean, not meaning nice in terms of being fancy, but nice in terms of people, which it had two rooms. And the people who, and the music was in the back room, and people who wanted to talk stayed in the front room, and people who went into the back room wanted to listen.
Right.
So they did. But they could have a beer. And who liked playing bars? Bill didn't like playing for us, but an audience that was sitting dead sober in a coffee house, at least not in those.
That's fascinating. And that's the environment at Club Pacine?
Club Pacine was a coffee house, yeah.
Right.
I mean, it was the classroom in town. And Club Pacine, once you reached the stage where you play a weekend, that was six sets. And the money was pretty good. You know, you would do Friday two sets, Saturday two sets, Sunday afternoon, and then one set Sunday evening. And it was the classy room in town. It was a step up from the Idler, but Bill just didn't like it as much. None of us did.
Interesting.
I mean, when I say us, that is the people who like sports.
Right, that makes sense.
And, you know, there was also a brief place called the Nameless Coffee House where you could go in and they didn't pay people to play, but you had to do an audition, and the audience didn't pay. And Bill played there at least once. I have a tape of him doing it set there.
Wow.
But the idea was that you use that to try out material because it wasn't as serious. But Bill didn't. That was what Bill took it with the thought that he would do that. And in the end, he went on and did it. But and you put Bill in front of an audience, and he wanted to do his best. I mean, Bill was always torn between wanting to experiment with new stuff and knowing how well he could do with what he was already doing. So he was constantly talking about things he would like to try and then sticking with what he knew worked.
You mentioned that in our first interview, and I wanted to get back on that theme. I think that's fascinating. Does that apply to both his songwriting process as well as his, like, I don't even know what to call it, his, like, managerial side, like, the bookings and his career side. Would you say that applied to both sides of that?
I actually refer to his songwriting. He stayed pretty experimental, and his booking, I mean, in those days, he was taking literally any gig he could get, and in later years, other people were doing the booking. No, it was about the performance and then about the... he was always ready to take chances as a writer.
Right. Interesting.
You know, I mean, the example I probably told you this to you last time. I mean, that song, He's Not From Kansas City. I mean, he was talking with me for months about how he was going to do that song. He was finally going to... He had got this older black jazz guy who had worked with Billie Holiday, and he was going to do more of a jazz album, and that song was for that. And then he went in and recorded it, you know, with his regular guy.
Why do you think that ultimately happened?
Because he ended up in a world that he didn't like or understand. I mean, Bill wanted to be Tom Waits.
Sorry, could you repeat that? He wanted to be what?
Tom Waits.
Tom Waits, right. You mentioned that. I see.
I mean, Bill felt like Tom Waits had kind of stolen his act. Not that Tom had seen his act, but Bill was someone, you know, he went on stage in a rumpled suit jacket, acting like an old-time beatnik.
Right.
And suddenly Tom Waits took over doing that thing.
Interesting.
You know, I'm now talking about, you know, early 1980s.
Right.
Late 70s, early 80s. And Bill had all this edgy, jazz-oriented material. I mean, I assume you've heard some of the stuff online.
Yes.
You know, the really early stuff.
I think so. I'm not sure, though. Where would I have found that? I've tried to find everything I could have found.
I've put a couple of things on SoundCloud.
I'll check that out. I might not have seen it.
I think I put up a couple of the full band tracks with the group called The Mental Retreat.
I have not seen that. I will, after this interview, I will go check that out. That's on your SoundCloud?
You know, if you look for a thing called, it would be in SoundCloud, let me just make sure what track I put up. Hold on a minute.
Sure.
Okay, now there I have my version of the song. I wonder if I don't have to. I think Candle Can Swing, I mean, it's not good. Yeah. Yeah, no, I can be the only one who ever did that one. But I mean, if you've been on my website, it's one of the ones I put up with it.
Yes. Yes, I've seen that.
Let me go to, okay. I mean, I know I put up a couple of...
So he had a full backing band you were alluding to?
He used to play... I mean, his home club... I never heard him in those days, but his home club was a place called the Stone Church in Newmarket, New Hampshire.
Right. I've heard about him, that place, and I've looked it up.
And he was a regular there.
Okay.
And he had a band that played with them. You've heard his single, The Free or Die?
Yes.
I mean, the original, not the version of the album.
I'm not sure, again.
Okay, because that was released as a single.
Right. I've heard the single. I have
before
a few copies.
Before he released any other recording.
Say that again?
Before he released any other recording.
Right. Correct. I know that. Right.
Okay. Let's see. I have...
No, take your time. I appreciate that.
I have no memory of what I put up.
Sure.
The one thing I hear from the full band is a thing called Morrissey Takes a Dive.
Morrissey Takes a Dive?
Yeah, by Bill Morrissey at the Mental Retreat.
And that's on SoundCloud?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, I will...
I'm listening to it right now.
I will go find that after our interview. That sounds fascinating. So,
There's only one tape, and it's not in great shape, but, you know, it's a cassette that was dumped. I don't know where his copy ended up, but I found one of the side musicians had a copy.
Okay.
The band, his main partner, and that was a guy named Trigger Cook.
Okay.
And Trigger is sort of interesting because he was the person who, I forget exactly his relationship to the brothers who formed the band, the Del Fuegos.
Okay.
And so they grew up on Bill Morrissey because of Trigger.
Okay.
Trigger was the lead guitarist on Live Free or Die on the original single.
Okay.
Which again, I'm pretty sure you can find that up on YouTube.
Okay, great. I had no idea that recording was on SoundCloud. I found it right now. I'm going to listen to it after our interview. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I have a whole bunch of stuff up there that has never been released anywhere, though.
Yeah, I imagine so. That's pretty fascinating.
I will eventually put up some more. I have to. Anyway, his idea was that he was sort of a more edgy and interesting figure musically. You know, he played trumpet, he played clarinet, he listened to jazz, he didn't like most of the singer-songwriter crowd. I don't mean he didn't like them as human beings.
Right, right. He wasn't.
But they were all sophisticated musicians.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you've talked to his friend Cormac.
I haven't. I hope to. You're the first person I've spoken to, but I would like to talk to a bunch of people now.
But, I mean, you know, Cormac is somebody who, like, I remember him at Bill's wedding. There was a wedding band, and, you know, Cormac is going up and singing standards and first singing them as him and then as Louis Armstrong. And, you know, I mean, they were very, very heavily into jazz.
Right, right, okay.
That's what they listened to. And Mississippi John Hurt and real, what I'm going to call real folk music, meaning the old stuff. But, I mean, you know, he had no interest. You know, if you ask Bill who the best songwriters in the country were, I mean, I remember us once having this conversation, because he thought he was one of the five best in the country. So the list, the rest of the list would have, you know, the three of the rest of the list would have been Bob Dylan, Tom Waits, and Randy Newman.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crowd he saw himself. As part of.
I personally don't think he was wrong.
That's irrelevant.
Right, no, sure.
What I mean is not his ability as a writer.
Right, but I mean his mindset.
That none of those people were folky singer-songwriters.
That's a good point.
I'm saying just generically.
Right.
I mean, it's not just that he thought he was a better songwriter than John Borka. He thought he was in an entirely different style of music.
Right, right, I see.
When he ended up in John Borka's style of music, and not only that, but wasn't doing as well, that was hard for him.
Right, sure.
And one of the ways, to my way of thinking, that it was hard for him, is he was suddenly in a world where people didn't like the music he liked, and yet they were the ones paying the bill.
Hmm.
I mean, people in his audiences were people who liked singer-songwriters.
Right.
There were people who might say, oh, you know, I actually like your stuff better than Tom Waits.
Interesting.
And, I mean, Bill might have thought, there might have been days when Bill thought he could write as well as Waits. But there was no day ever that he thought he'd done an album as good as Rain Notes.
Right, yeah. Okay, right.
I mean, he wanted to make records that sounded like Rain Notes.
Wow.
And instead he was making records that sounded like the usual folky bullshit.
Right. I see.
And when I knew him in the early 80s, he was still thinking he hadn't yet made any records.
Hmm.
And he was still thinking in terms of, you know, I mean, you know, when he, first time he talked about adding another instrument to a recording, other than just him and his pals, Ed Gerhardt and Reed Wesley, who were, I don't know if you know those names.
I don't.
Reed Wesley was his bass player. I don't know how Wesley is known, but it's Grieg as in the Norwegian composer.
Okay.
And Grieg played bass for Bill when Bill got a big enough gig that he could hire a bass player.
Okay.
And Ed Gerhardt, you can still look up. I mean, Ed, Ed's still around and still performing.
Right. Okay.
And Ed Gerhardt, Bill always called him Driveway Wilson. I don't know where the name came from. Bill would always introduce his sidemen with made-up names.
Okay.
And that one stuck. So I didn't even know Ed's real name until considerably after I knew him as Driveway.
Yeah.
And I mean, he would also, I mean, Grieg, you know, I remember him introducing Grieg as Charlie Mingus Phantom. A mass murdering bass player. But anyway, where I was going was, aside from those guys, when he was doing his second album and decided he'd have more stuff on it, the first thing he thought of was, okay, and then we'll add a bass player in it.
Okay.
I mean, that was how he thought.
Interesting.
And for example, on his third album, on Standing Eight, which Darlene Wilson produced. The one place where Bill put his foot down was on Girls of Santa Fe. You know the track?
I do.
Okay. Where Darlene had put together a sort of mariachi thing.
Okay.
And Bill, that's where Bill put his foot down and said, no, we are not having mariachi on here. And he wrote that atonal trumpet.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
And so that album, I mean, it's all playing in sync by that album. And it worked. I mean, She's Some Kind of Mystery and Summer Night got more radio play than anything else he'd ever done.
Right. How did he feel about those songs? You expressed how you felt about those in the past interview. How did he feel about those?
Look, you could not... You could not criticize Bill to Bill.
Understood.
I mean, I don't know that I ever told Bill what I thought of those songs. You know, if Bill wrote something that worked for him, he was not going to say it was shit.
Right.
And if Bill wrote something that didn't work, he would drop it from his repertoire, even if he liked it.
Okay.
I mean, Bill was a performer.
Right.
You know, Tom Rush was managing him.
When did that management take over?
That world,
okay.
Right?
When did that relationship start with Tom Rush?
I would have said right around Standing Eight.
Okay.
And you know, so he was writing songs for that kind of situation, and it worked. End of story.
Right, that makes sense.
And you know, then he took a band on the road when he was doing a little bit better, and he got, oh, what's the guy's name who played with John Mayall's Blues Breakers, or with the Yardbirds, I don't remember which of them, after Eric Clapton left, or
okay.
Before Eric Clapton, sorry, he was the guy before Eric Clapton. And Bill was so perfect, you know, Bill was so excited about that. Peter Kane would know about that, he was on that tour.
Okay.
But, yeah, no, I knew him better in the earlier days. And in the later days, you know, we would still get together, but we wouldn't talk about what he was doing.
Right.
I mean, there was so much bitterness. I don't mean between us. But, I mean, you know, it's all there in Edsa.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's such a stupidly vicious book. I mean, it isn't even vicious. You know, he's putting all these characters in that book who are people he feels have done him wrong, and he's going to put them in fiction now, and maybe they'll read it and realize how wrong they are. And it's just, why do that? But he was that way. You know, he has, what is it, Motels and Trains. He has that line about Tom Rush, you know, I've got a manager now who was famous once.
Right.
And all he tells me to do is play what?
Play safe and nice, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, do I think he agreed with me? Yeah, it's right there in the song.
Right. I see.
But, you know, if a month after that record came out, he was bitching and moaning, and I said, and I happened to murmur, I've got no right to complain. He did not laugh.
Right. Interesting. That's very...
You know, but the time that we were close was long before that.
Right.
Not long in years, but in terms of his career.
Yes. That makes sense.
I mean, look, he was a genius. He was doing incredible shows, and he was getting nowhere.
Why do you think that was?
Well, the scene was pretty dead.
Hmm.
I mean, nobody was getting much anywhere. I mean, I think, you know, when Suzanne broke out a little bit, that sort of gave some new life to the scene.
Right.
Suzanne Baker.
Yes.
But, you know, that bothered him too.
Were they close?
No. I mean, look, they were friends. She sang on his album.
Right.
When he wrote Edson, she's in there as the character.
Right.
Who is doing her next album and is stuck, so she's calling Bill to help her write her song.
Right.
That's what he thought of Suzanne.
Right.
I mean, what was the name of, the name of his album with Trains and the title right near the beginning?
Night Train?
Is that what it's called? It's one of the relatively early albums. Hold on, let's go to Discogs and make sure I'm getting this one right. Because I don't know the album. I mean, it's not that I at least for a while was still listening to every record he put out.
Right.
Hold on.
Sure, take your time.
Let me look at what the tracks are. guess at night time. It's funny, I didn't remember how late some of the days on those, but it's okay, so there's quite a while between records.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's Night Train I'm thinking of, which... See, this is what I'm looking at doesn't really fit what I'm remembering. But I think it is Night Train that he said that was about how all the... how they're only giving record contracts to the women on record.
Right, you mentioned that.
Anyway, I don't know that record well. But anyway, that's for today. That's the later time. I mean, the early time, you know, he was playing lousy bars in New Hampshire, and then he broke into the Cambridge scene. And he was... But New York was never good to him. You know, New York always... New York didn't like people who weren't from New York.
Right. Interesting.
I mean, New York always viewed Bill as... the guy who... as the competition for David Massengill.
Interesting. I don't know. I don't know his work.
Okay, well, they were the two... the two brilliant songwriters of that moment. They were the same age. They were really good friends. They
okay.
liked each other a lot. And they were both really, really good. And they both... David moved to New York. Bill moved to Cambridge. And Bill had thought about moving to New York.
Okay.
But as it ended up, David was in New York and Bill was in Cambridge, and their careers took different paths because of that. And you've never heard of David.
Right. No, I haven't. I just do.
But David was from New York, and so when Rounder Philo went to Bill and to David and to a couple of other people who were the hot songwriters of the moment, Patty Larkin, and tried to launch all of them, David, being in New York, was not interested on being a minor label like Rounder Philo. He wanted to be on A&M or Sony.
Right.
And so he actually agreed to go with Rounder. You know, so he ended up putting out an album that was cost a fortune, that was produced by the same guy who had produced I forget what. And they sold it, and you've never heard of it.
Interesting.
Rather than putting out a bunch of records on Rounder Philo and having one bigger than so, he would have gone bigger than so.
Wow, that's so fascinating. So he never got that deal that he was hoping for, I'm assuming.
Right.
Wow.
And being in New York, he wasn't going to agree to anything smaller.
Wow.
And meanwhile, the New York people, I'll never forget seeing Bill be brought into the speakeasy as an opening act for Suzanne Vega. Because she could pack the place, and she was the person they wanted to have a huge audience. They had figured out that Suzanne was the one who could really hit out of that world. I mean, they were not, you know, Jack Hardy was not stupid. I didn't like the man, but he was not stupid.
Who was he?
So they booked, he was the guiding light of the speakeasy.
Okay.
Which was the bar where this all was happening in New York.
I see.
And he wanted to showcase Suzanne, so he gave her a headlining night and brought Bill in as an opening act, because Bill would in fact draw an audience. And it made Bill very, very, very angry.
That makes sense. That's interesting. You mentioned that.
What?
That's an interesting time. Around what time was that show, do you know?
When was that show?
Right. Yeah, what time period are we talking about here? Is this the Tom Rush era?
I mean, it's before... It's before Suzanne had ever done a recording.
Okay.
Except on the speakeasy. Like, this is the Fast Folk Records, if you've ever, if you've run across them.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So, you know, she has probably recorded a couple of songs on Fast Folk by then.
Okay. But her first album hadn't come out?
No.
Okay, well, that was 85, so we're talking about early 80s then? 84, maybe?
Oh, we're talking, yeah, somewhere around there.
Wow. Right around, that's so interesting, because isn't that when Bill's first album came out, was around 84, was 84? Yeah, wow, interesting, okay. And where was the speakeasy in Manhattan?
Was already, you know, Bill was already a happening thing by then.
Hmm.
I mean, the first album, you know, by the time we brought out the first album, when did we bring out the first album? Is it in fact 84 that it already got that on record?
That's what it says online, but I want you to see if you can confirm that.
No, that's probably right.
Okay.
Yeah, that could well be right.
Okay.
So, 80. So yeah, that would have been 84. So yeah, so right around then. But I mean, by that time, you know, Poe was already a real thing in Boston. And, you know, he had been a thing in New York. I mean, he'd been doing it for 10 years already.
Okay.
You know, he was a known quantity. And, I mean, he had fervent fans.
Hmm. Were they mostly located around the Cambridge area? Or were they all throughout the Northeast? Or where was his...
The really fervent ones were the New Hampshire ones.
Okay, right. That makes sense.
You know, Cambridge was already... You know, people loved him in Cambridge and Boston, but... But the people, you know, who owned him were the New Hampshire crowd.
Right.
You know, the Stone Church in Newmarket and the Press Room in Portsmouth. I mean, those were the places where Bill was gone.
Fascinating. So, yeah.
Those were the places where, like, you know, the Del Fuego. Do you know the name when I say the Del Fuego?
No.
Okay, they had a moment of being rock and roll stars.
Okay.
And I mean, you know, there was a moment there where people became rock and roll stars and remembered Bill as one of the giants.
Right.
That's very much New Hampshire.
Okay.
And they remembered, you know, I remember playing a club in Davis, California, and mentioning Bill Morrissey, and somebody from the audience yelling out a request for a song called Stupid People in Positions of Power.
Wow.
Which does not exist anywhere. I, as far as I know, there is no tape of it, and no one remembers it.
Wow.
I mean, I remember it. I can't sing it.
Right.
But I mean, I remember what it was. I mean, it was one of his nasty, funny songs.
Right.
He had a lot of those.
I find it fascinating, in your role as a music historian, you're kind of filling that role for Bill with that song you put on your album, and how many songs would you say that you could either play or reference that you might be the only person that could play or reference? There's no known recording for it of Bill's.
In terms of no known recording, I'm trying to remember whether I have. Billy Soldiers Pay. I don't know if anyone else knows Candlepin Swing. The other one I put up there, what's it called? The bus riding one.
Yeah, I love that one. The chorus is so great. It's not coming through right now.
So there is a handful, and for other people out there in the world who remember a handful that nobody else remembered. He did record Candlepin Swing with the Mental Retread. So that's it. And, I mean, there is a tape out there from 1974 with a bunch of stuff that I don't even know.
Oh, wow.
Before my time.
You have that tape?
I have a copy of it. I'd have to figure out who I got it from.
Whoa. That's wild. Oh, sure,
and,
sure.
You know, it includes a bunch of stuff that I do remember, and it's not all of it from 74, though it says it is.
Wow.
Because it includes a thing called The Day Mose Allison Raised His Voice, and I remember when Bill started doing that one.
What a title. Okay. Interesting.
That's his song about the apocalypse.
Wow. Okay.
And again, you know, I mean, he was, a lot of what Bill did was edgy and funny stuff.
Right.
I mean, I'm pretty sure I put a version of Sweaty Woman. I know I put a version of Sweaty Woman up on SoundCloud.
Oh, wow.
And for example, that's a song that till the day he died, he kept telling me that each album, you know, next album I'm going to get together a jazz band and do Sweaty Woman.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Oh, fascinating. Okay. All right. So, thank you for all that. Let me think. Going back to where we left it before that. Who was with Philo Rounder, and how did they come about to him, and what is Reckless, and can you explain what that means, Philo Rounder, and then Reckless Records?
Reckless Records was just something me and Bill invented. I mean, the way the name happened was I wanted something with alliteration, so I wanted it to begin with an R.
Okay.
And Bill went through the dictionary and pulled out a bunch of words that began with an R that he thought could work. And one of them was Reckless, and I picked it.
All right.
So, I mean, I forget his whole list of R's, but, I mean, he had come up with a list of maybe 9 words that began with R.
And the
idea of the company was, Philo had been a separate record company. Philo had nothing to do with Rounder.
Okay.
And they had gone out of business. And they had gone out of business with a Dave Van Ronk album completed that was now just sitting there. And that had been sitting there for a couple of years, and it was driving Dave bonkers. He had this completed album and it was not getting put out.
Right.
And he had tried to get Rounder to put it out. They had passed on it. He tried a couple other places and they had passed. And so finally I came up with the idea that how about we put out, you know, how about we start a record company and put out Dave's records and also our records. And because Dave was a known quantity, we could get distribution, and it would give us all, it would get Dave's record out so he'd have it. And me and Bill would have our first albums out, and they'd be attached to Dave, which would give it some kind of legitimacy and not just feel like a vanity label.
Right.
And so that's what we did.
That's fascinating. So was it costly to buy the rights to that record, or were they just throwing it in, or how did that work?
Getting the rights from Philo, you mean?
Right, the album that was in the can of Dan Van Rocks that nobody would put out. Like,
my memory is that Philo made us reimburse them the recording costs.
Okay.
And my memory is that when I say us, that means me.
Interesting.
But I'm not sure. That's my memory is that that's how that worked. And that I then took that out of the first bunch of sales. And I mean, the idea was we didn't sign any paperwork.
Huh. Interesting.
No, nobody involved in Reckless ever signed anything.
Wow.
There was a moment where Bill was being advised by somebody who was giving him all sorts of professional advice. That's professional in quotation marks. And part of the professional advice was that he should sign a contract with me. And he came over one day and said, you know, I've been talking to her and she says that we should sign a contract. And I said, why? And he said, so, you know, we'll have it all laid out. And I said, Bill, if we don't sign a contract, you simply have put out your album and I own nothing of it. Why would you want to sign a contract with me? And when 6 months later, Rounder came to him and said that they wanted to put out that record, I said, right, Bill, see why you didn't want to sign a contract with me?
Interesting.
Your teacher just walked. I mean, what happened was that we put out those three records, and we got distribution all over the country from various distributors. I mean, we had New City Music in Minneapolis, and I forget what Chris Rockwitz's distribution was in the Bay Area. And Rounder was distributing us in the Northeast, and within, I don't know how many months, three, four, five, within a month or two, Bill had sold out his first 1,000, and we'd ordered another 1,000, and they were pretty much sold out, and Rounder was watching them fly out the door and said, hey, how about you switch over and give us this one?
Interesting.
So that's what it is.
And how long was he with Rounder?
Forever.
Right. Interesting.
But I mean, that's what happened. The Rounder was interested, and then they saw how much he was selling, and they got interested. So it worked.
It certainly did. Seems to have been fascinating.
You know, my record didn't sell. My record was terrible. But it did get me a gig.
I like your record a lot, by the way.
Anyway, it worked well for all of us.
Interesting. Okay. And you guys both did the initial thousand round for both of your records?
We originally got 1,000 each. And we had to reorder Bill's really fast.
And what about Dave Van Rollins? Was that done on 1,000 too? Or was that more?
Yeah, no, we got 1,000. I don't think we ever had a reorder. I'm not sure.
Okay. Interesting.
And then a few months later, I guess Cormac McCarthy wanted to put out a record on Reckless, maybe a year or a year and a half later, whatever. And I said, sure, if you're president of the label. And at that point, Cormac put out one record on Reckless and then ceased to be mine. And then Ed Gerhardt put out a record on Reckless. And by that time, I had nothing, you know. I mean, as soon as we put out those first three records, I wanted nothing more to do with them.
Interesting.
I mean, the deal was, you know, if you'll start answering mail, you can have the record number. Whoever wanted it.
Right. Cool. That's really interesting. So it was a vehicle to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah,
it worked. Wow. That's really fascinating. Did you guys like form an LLC? I mean, you fill the paperwork to make it an official business, or was it just like a name?
That's what I was saying. We never did anything.
Wow. It was just, you just said what it was, and it was that.
With no paperwork of any kind involved.
That's fascinating. Wow.
I mean, why?
Right.
I mean, you know, Dave Van Rollins always had the same sewer beg to get lights. I mean, there was no money and, you know, nobody was making any money.
Right.
Why pay a lawyer?
Right, sure. Interesting. That's fascinating. Yeah, thank you. You've been so gracious.
I mean, it was very, very typical, Bill, that he loved that. He came right in on it. We were completely... But anytime somebody took him aside and said, gee, Bill, you know, shouldn't you have a contract? Gee, Bill, do you really want to be reporting for, you know, there was a moment when he almost jumped ship.
Right.
because he had sent, you know, somebody who ran a local folk magazine. Hey, you know, I'm thinking of starting a record label. I have the power of my folk magazine, and I have all these connections. And you know, why don't you put out your record on my label instead?
Right.
And Bill showed up at my door and said, oh, gee, I'm sorry. I think I'm going to go do that. And, I mean, I just said, you know, really, Bill? You know, this is a label with no, that doesn't exist yet. And you think it's going to do way better for you than coming out along with that loser, Dave Van Brom. And he came back and, you know, it all worked out. But, you know, he always, you know, he liked the music he liked the people he liked. And by the time I met him, he had figured out that most of the world didn't.
Okay.
And that making a living might involve other sorts of behavior.
Right.
And it worked, except in the ways it didn't work.
What ways didn't it work? Like creatively for his career and things like that? His fulfillment creatively?
It didn't work in the sense that nobody but me will ever say his name next to Tom Waits' name rather than next to John Carpenter.
Right. Well, yes. Well, very few people. You're speaking to one person who will, but yes, I know what you mean. You're right. Okay, so he never got success like Dylan.
I mean, it isn't about success. I mean, it's about, you know, nobody's naming him next to Tim Harden. You know, the people he liked were not the soft folkies.
Right.
And he ended up as one of the soft folkies.
Interesting. I'm interested in how how that destiny fulfilled itself and all that. Oh, you said in our previous interview that he signed with Tom Rush around the Standing Eight time, like you mentioned. Tom Rush told him, don't take less than $1,000 to play. And you mentioned that he was playing for Yuppies, who you said, like Summer Night over Small Town River. Was the Tom Rush years the first time he was taking his act outside of the regional area of the Northeast, or had he been to like the 48 States bars and like going around the continental U.S. His pre-day?
No.
Okay.
He had never done much. I don't think he done any tour.
Okay.
I mean, he had hitchhiked around. He and Cormac lived in a garage in Los Angeles for a while, but he had not done.
Okay.
So that's what, and I mean, the time with Tom Rush, I don't think he could out of New England hardly at all.
Oh, really?
I mean, that didn't work out very well.
I see.
And I don't really know when that shifted up, when he started touring more. I mean, I guess by the time he's seeing motels and planes, he must be in some.
Right. Okay, interesting.
But I mean, those would be questions to ask people who were, you know, I mean, I could have answered that question if you'd asked me that year.
Sure.
But I was no longer really hanging out.
That makes sense.
I mean, once he and Ellen were married, I really wasn't hanging out with him.
I see.
I mean, which is not a slight on Ellen.
Right, right.
I mean, the world had really shifted by then.
Sure.
I mean, I remember, I mean, I remember visiting him a couple of times when he and Ellen were living first in Boston and then the place they got after that. I mean, it's not like I was out of touch. But we were just on different paths from there.
That makes sense.
Um,
he always wanted to move out to the country. And so before that, I mean, he had bought a house with Lisa. So he was doing well enough to buy a house.
Right.
That's well before Ellen. And then he and Lisa broke up, and he was back in a railroad flat in Newmarket with his dog.
Right.
And then he got together with Ellen. And I don't remember the years for all of this. I mean, partly because I was off and out of the country.
Okay.
I mean, I would be back in the country for a couple of years and then away for a couple of years.
Okay.
So that's part of what's going on there. But, you know, there are all these gaps where, like, I wasn't there for wedding with Ellen because I was somewhere else. For joining with Lisa, I was there for the wedding with Ellen.
Okay.
For the wedding with Lisa, I was out of the country for, I don't know, year and a half. Whatever.
Well.
So, I mean, there are hunks of things that I know.
What do you think Bill's, like, legacy or greatest contribution to songwriting, or...
Do you think he has one?
I do. I was wondering if you do.
Name me somebody who was writing differently because Bill was on the planet.
Well, I'm not sure that I can on the spot, but I do believe that there are. I know I am. I know my mentor, Paul Allen, he's of your generation, but he was heavily, heavily inspired. He's got two or three albums. Outside of that small link, I don't know, but I haven't really sought it, but I do believe that it's there.
I mean, it would be nice. I'm glad to know there are a couple of people out there.
Sure, absolutely.
But that's—I don't think it's more than that.
I understand.
I personally think that that's because the writing changed.
Sorry, that's because of what?
The writing change.
I see.
I mean, I think that the stuff he was doing that was unique, he stopped doing rather quickly. Because it wasn't selling. And, yeah, I was absolutely fascinated when he died and they did a tribute concert for him. I didn't go to the tribute concert.
Right.
I was invited to come and spend. I was living in Los Angeles. And I looked at the list of people who were invited and saw a list that was going to do anything that makes me angry. But I did check with somebody who was there, and nobody sang anything from the first two albums or earlier.
Right, no, I did notice that.
Even from the first three albums or earlier. And, you know, that's because they had different tastes.
Right.
They were people who liked the music that he did later, more than they liked the music he did earlier. And they weren't the only ones. So did that whole world he was working.
Right. That makes sense.
And, you know, that's my take on it is, here's a perfect example. There's a writer named Luke Sant.
Okay.
He wrote a review or whatever of Bob Dylan's Chronicles for the New York Review of Books.
Okay.
When Chronicles came out. And it was a sufficiently insightful review that Dylan proceeded to give Luke a lot of work for the next few years because Dylan thought it was such an insightful review. And the thing that Luke said, which I was struck by and which is why I'm bringing this up, was he drew attention to the fact Dylan, like me, apparently thinks that Dylan's greatest work as a songwriter
the brilliant work, not the greatest work, but the brilliant work is up through Blanco Blanc, and after that it's Bolo. And the way Luke phrased it was, a lot of people think that Bolo on the Tracks is Dylan's best album. Because it's the album, it's the best album he wrote that they could ever imagine themselves writing.
Wow, that's so good. Oh my God.
Whereas they can imagine themselves writing How I See.
Right, right. Or Sad Eye Lady. Or, yeah, wow, that's incredible. That's such a good one.
And that sort of is where I come out on them.
Right.
That, you know, Birches is the sort of song that a lot of less talented people think if they had built talent, they could write.
Right. Interesting.
But Small Town, no.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's so good. Yeah, I can totally understand that. Well, we're of the same ilk. Small Town's one of my favorite songs. And, yeah, I love the first album. It's my favorite album.
I mean, I like Birch.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, but Birch is, I think Birch is a very well-written song. I think it also was another attempt to grab the brass ring of the trend.
Right.
I mean, Birch's, I have absolutely no question in my mind, but that the point of Birch's was that one of the women who were doing better than him could cover.
Right, sure.
That he was writing a woman's song at last, after years of all the women who were becoming stars, saying, gee, Bill, I'd love to do one of your songs, you're also male. You know, that's it.
And why hasn't that song been covered by...
Good question.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Right. Okay.
Still could be. That still could be.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely.
You know, it hasn't been covered because that's not how, you know, it's not how it went.
Right. Sure. Sure.
And because the choice was too cynical.
Say that again?
And because the choice was too cynical.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's a good woman's song, but there are lots of women writing good woman's songs.
Right. It's been an hour. I would talk to you for a whole day, but I don't want to be cavalier with your time. I could ask you a couple more questions just to keep it in some
okay,
concise.
Okay, got a couple more. Let's do a couple more, and then I should get
back. Okay, great. I noticed that Bill only got a critical acclaim from the Grammy organization for his two albums that weren't his own original songs. The Friend of Mine album with Greg Brown, and then the cover of the Mississippi John Hurt album. Any insight into that from Bill's perspective? I think you already kind of...
Come on, that one's easy.
Yeah.
It's because that's about Grammy. That's how the Grammys work.
If
you're going for best traditional folk album, you're up against a lot of old guys who may not have many people voting for them. And if you're for contemporary folk album, you're against all the young hotshots on major labels.
Interesting.
I mean, that's just political.
Okay.
It's just that those albums are in different Grammy categories.
Fascinating. Also, in your previous interview, you mentioned that his stage persona with the kind of like biting comedy was a means to get the audience to listen. Was that learned behavior? He evolved in that way, or he came in equipped with that, or could you explain a little bit of how that worked off stage?
You know, by the time I knew him, he had it. So I don't know. I mean, that was all, you know, it was also something that interested him. I mean, when he started hanging out with Barry Crimmins, again, another of the things that never happened, he kept talking about how he wanted to go out to some of the comedy open mics and try just doing stand-up and see whether he could make it work without a guitar.
Interesting.
Which, again, he never did.
Do you know how Bill felt about Pete Seeger? As a performer, I'm just curious if it ever came up, because I'm assuming he had, you mentioned he respected Woody a lot, and he respected Bill a lot. I was wondering if, where he saw Pete Seeger in terms of performer, and,
Well, I mean,
I would say he basically would have Seeger the same way. You know, Steve Van Rock always, if you ask him what he thought of Seeger, his response was, you know, what can I say? He's the man who invented my profession.
Cool.
You know, Seeger was simply, you know, I mean, Bill, I mean, he had his little, he had his one Pete Seeger crack in show.
I don't think I heard that one.
He was, okay, so Bill's big sing-along number was the theme from Petticoat Jones. He would announce it as his big sing-along number and then say, you know, this audience, I can tell you, is so hip that I'm not even going to have to tell you what your part is. And then he would go into the Petticoat Junction. Do you know what that is?
I don't.
Okay, well, go online and you can find it.
Okay.
And it was a TV show, and it, the theme song, it, at the end of the verse, everybody yells Petticoat Junction.
Okay.
And so the audience would do that. And Bill would go, oh, I feel just like Seeger now. And he did a perfect Seeger.
Oh, that's funny.
If we could just all join hands all around the world, 5/8 of us would drown.
That's funny.
So, you know, that was his one Seeger, official Seeger comment. But no, I mean, Seeger was gone.
Right.
I mean, we all worship Seeger.
Okay. Cool.
I mean, no one will ever understand. No one who was not in a room watching Seeger when Seeger was still Seeger will ever understand. If you were, there was no one who was in one of those rooms who did not come away understanding that they'd seen something. I mean, he was, there's nothing like that. I mean, what that guy did to an audience, no performer in any genre cannot be, you know, Bob Dylan, the last interview I saw where he talked about Seeger, he said, you know, Seeger was like a shaman. I mean, Seeger was transformative.
Hmm.
There's nothing on a Pete Seeger record will give you the faintest idea of what Seeger did.
Right.
I mean, Seeger's art died with it.
Hmm.
But, you know, those of us who grew up with that available to us, you don't, I mean, in a sense, I'd say you don't have, you didn't have an opinion on Seeger.
Right.
I mean, what, and honestly, you know, Baez was that way too.
Hmm.
I mean, in a very different way.
Interesting.
But, I mean, if you never saw Baez live when she was, you know, when she still really had it, there's no way to understand things people say about her. Because it is completely, and you know, and yeah, that was true of Bill in that early period.
Wow.
And it ceased to be true of Bill later, and people, you know, people will never understand that. That's life.
Thank you so much. I could not be more grateful for our conversation. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Wallop. Have a great day. Bye-bye. I want to thank Elijah Wald for being our first guest. And thank everyone for listening. Follow us on social media for more information about future episodes. Until next time.